So, what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
I would have liked to stay with you longer, but I find consolation in the words of Jesus. He tells us, the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything and remind you of all I have said to you. The Father sends His Spirit of truth and love into the world, and the Spirit guides us in the ways of peace. Therefore, do not let your hearts be troubled or afraid. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Spirit is with you.
Amen. That is the strong, the paternal voice of St. John Paul II. Hello and welcome to Trending. My name is Brooke Taylor, filling in for Temery on the feast of St. John Paul II. And what a show we have for you today. A powerful guest on deck who combines flying F-18 fighter jets with G.K. Chesterton, dogfights, aerial battles with Aristotle, the Naval Academy, and the importance of a classical liberal arts education in the Catholic tradition. So this is an invitation, I would say, to round up the guys that you know, especially, I think for everyone, this is a conversation, but teen boys, young men, husbands, fathers, this is for you, and also a great call to leadership that we will be invited into today. So we will get into that. The number to call is 1-888-914-9149. And going back to that extraordinary nostalgic beauty, the voice of John Paul II at the top of the show, the call from St. John Paul the Great is not to let your hearts be troubled. And we could believe his words when he said it because of the totality of the sacrifice he himself made. And we will see that. We saw that through the loss of his parents, both parents, and the trauma of World War II, the assassination attempt, his Parkinson's, and all that he carried. And he would say, don't waste your suffering. There is a true story that I love, and I think it sets the tone for today's program. It likens Pope John Paul II to Frodo in Lord of the Rings, the great Tolkien epic. And he said, Frodo is Pope John Paul the greatest man in the worst century of history, who carried more of the burden of the ring than anyone else in the world. And as Sam carried Frodo and the ring for a little while up Mount Doom, Walter Hooper carried this burden for a split second when Mr. Hooper visited the Pope and received his blessing in the form of the laying on of papal hands on his shoulders. Hooper said he felt the entire weight of the world in his body, which was suddenly on fire with unendurable pain and pressure. He looked up at the Pope's eyes and saw the source of the pain there. The Pope said, I'm sorry, I did not know that would happen, and took his hands, the burden, off Walter's shoulders. That is a very penetrating story, and I read it in the latest book from Dr. Peter Kreeft, but it gives us a glimpse into what St. John Paul the Great carried, more than we will ever know, the side of heaven. And that's what I love, is hearing the stories of how our Lord works through the saints in a very intimate way in our own lives and around the world. That's one of the things I love about pilgrimage and traveling and reading, because we know that God is always moving. And whenever we have an opportunity to encounter Him in a soul that has been transfigured, it is unforgettable, because there is no other explanation. And of course, sacred scripture is full of stories and parables, and the hagiography of the saints is full of the narratives of how they lived out a total abandonment to the will of God. Their lives were transformed, and the evidence par excellence of their response to God's hand in their lives. And so I'm looking on social media today on the feast of St. John Paul II and realizing again the stories of the intercession of Pope John Paul II and how innumerable they are. And I know too, because he's a contemporary saint, we were blessed to be there for his canonization. But I wanted to share a quick story, because it's one of those things where I just laugh, and you know that it's between you and our Lord, and how I would always hear these stories and read the stories of the saints and listen to testimonies and never imagined in my own life that I would have that kind of experience until it happened with St. John Paul II. And it's a very long story, but I'll just say that it starts with a baby born in Poland. This baby was abandoned and disabled and left in a hospital without a name. And at the same time, halfway across the world, there was a couple who had experienced multiple miscarriages, secondary infertility, but also feeling called to adopt. And that couple was my husband and I. We had three boys, secondary infertility, many losses, open to life. And after an unexpected invitation to Washington, D.C. to watch a film, the premiere of 9 Days That Changed the World, it documents Pope John Paul II's historic visit to Poland for the first time after being named Pope, and then the subsequent fall of communism there. But particularly, this documents after his visit to Częstochowa, Poland. It's somewhat of the spiritual heart of the country. And shortly after, God opens this door as we pray to adopt a child and led us to an orphanage in Poland. And my husband always said, there's so many kids in our own country that need good homes. But what I learned, I think what we all learned, ourselves, our family, the people that walked with us on this journey, is sometimes God knits families together in ways that are unexpected. Joseph was the foster father, and he asks us for openness to trust. Jesus, I trust in you. And one quick note about that. John Paul II had a lifelong devotion to Our Lady of Częstochowa, the Black Madonna, and that was especially intensified after the death of his mom, Amelia. And so he would go, he would pilgrimage there to Jasna Góra and to Częstochowa. And as I mentioned, our daughter was born premature. She was left in the hospital without a name. And had I not lived through the experience, I don't know that I would have believed such a direct intercession. But we are reminded that by faith, when we are called to go out to a place that we are to receive as an inheritance, God is with us. This is the story of Abraham in Hebrews 11. He went out not knowing where he was going. And of all of the orphanages in all of Poland, there are over 700. The place that our daughter would be was an orphanage just blocks away from Jasna Góra Monastery in Częstochowa, Poland. And as I mentioned, born without a name, we, in our prayers, not knowing if we would adopt a boy or a girl, thought we had a boy name picked out and a girl, Mary Grace. This name, Carolina, though, continued to come in my heart and mind unexplainably. So we made kind of a change, and I asked my husband, we talked to our kids, Carolina would be the name if that would be God's will. The night that I had told a friend about this, our adoption agent called and she said, we have your referral. And in the adoption process, the child essentially is called a referral. You receive a piece of paper with brief, very scant, usually medical history, what they know about that child and perhaps a picture. So she called and said, we have your referral after a year and a half of an FBI dossier and all that goes into it. And so we put her on speaker. And at that moment, she said, you're the girl. It's a girl. She's a little girl. She's 9 months old. She has blonde hair, and her name is Carolina. So this name that we had no idea God already gave to us, and it's the feminine name of Carol Wojtyła, Carolina. So just a reminder that God calls us by name. Isaiah 43:1, do not fear. I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. And that choosing life, her mother, her biological mother, chose life, that it's never an anti to choose life. It is always a nuclear yes to a future and a hope and a possibility and this detonation of immortal light that has already been sparked in the mother's womb. And Pope John Paul II was a pro-life pope for the ages. And so we, in our home, we affectionately call him Lolek, his childhood nickname. But what a beautiful invitation now to learn more about John Paul II. And yesterday, I pulled up one of his speeches, put it on the television, read it for our four sons, and he was such an amazing orator. And so I wanted to just read a portion because for all of us, we can be galvanized by what he had to say. This was Pope John Paul II in 1983. So imagine this time. He went back 9 times in the course of his pontificate to Poland, 1983. And he says this at Jasna Góra. And Think about when he says Poland, transposing his homeland with the United States, and how accurate his words are to what's happening in our own country here and now. This is just a brief excerpt of what he says. He says, make an effort to be a person with a conscience. I do not stifle this conscience, and I do not deform it. I call good and evil by name, and I do not blur them. I develop in myself what is good, and I seek to correct what is evil by overcoming it in myself. My dear friends, it is up to you to put a firm barrier against immorality. Historical experiences tell us how much the immorality of certain periods cost the whole nation. Therefore, watch. Christ said to the apostles during his prayer in Gethsemane, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. I watch also means feeling responsible for this great common inheritance whose name is Poland. This name defines us all. This name obliges us all. This name costs us all. And when you go on to read that speech in its entirety, I actually think it's reminiscent in some ways to the commencement address delivered by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the United States at Harvard 5 years prior. So much to think about, and how soon history repeats itself. And that will be part of what you'll hear today in our story with our special guest. And John Paul II reminds us to put into the deep, let down your nets for a catch, and that the cosmic drama of God's creative and redemptive purposes is in all of our lives, is planted there. And our guest today knows a little something about that cosmic drama. He is Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari. His early life was riddled with chaos. We'll hear a bit of that. Eventually, he would find a path of success through education, where he won a scholarship to the world-renowned Phillips Academy of Andover, Massachusetts. By the time he entered college, he was a committed atheist. Ali joined the Navy, and following his graduation from Officer Candidate School, he entered flight training and flew more than 20 missions in the F-18 Hornet in Taliban-occupied Afghanistan. But something happened. He was actually confronted with the existential, and we'll get to the question of God and how that happened. But it changed his life. Ali began to study the Catholic faith while learning how to dogfight. He would later go on to join the faculty at the Naval Academy, and now is the headmaster of the school he founded along with his wife, Divine Mercy Academy, in the Severna Park, Maryland area. Commander and Mrs. Ghaffari are parents of three daughters, two foster children, and delighted to welcome him now to Trending. Welcome to the show, Lieutenant Commander Ghaffari.
Thank you, Brooke. It's so nice to be here.
Your mother, your story, where to begin? Your story is so incredible. And I want to begin with life, that yes to life. Your mother, I know, became pregnant at a young age, 15. Your dad was 18, an immigrant from Iran. What were those early years like for you?
Well, I can't imagine what that first conversation was like when my mom told my grandparents that she was pregnant. That must have been really hard. My grandmother suggested that my mom get an abortion, and my mom, to her incredible credit, decided to keep me, and I'm grateful for that. And so she kept me. She graduated from high school early. She's really smart. And they tried to make a go of it. So they got married, and they moved in initially with my grandparents, and then they started to move out to make a life of their own, and moved around quite a bit. And my brother was born about 20 months later. But after about 3 years, it just didn't work. And in fact, my first memory comes from about then. My first memory is the memory of my parents fighting in the other room. And then my mom left my dad and brought my brother and I, we moved from Florida to Vermont. And I remember coming out of the airport in Burlington and just looking into the darkness and just seeing these snowflakes come down. His first memory of seeing snow. And just wondering what is life going to be like. And for the next probably 4 years, it was chaotic. We moved every year. There was a revolving door of men coming through our home. My mom got a job as a bartender where she worked in the evenings. And my brother and I, she didn't have childcare, so we were there. We spent our evenings in the bar with her, drinking Shirley Temples, playing video games, watching my mom play pool. My mom, you know, it didn't take long for her living in that kind of lifestyle to get into the drugs and alcohol and get tied up with some, you know, some unsavory characters. And so we just had surrounded by a lot of just let's just say sketchy people, and living in just strange, just not very nice places. I remember having food and milk delivered door to door in crates, and thinking that's just the way it happened. So it was chaotic. There was a lot of instability. We didn't make any friends because we were always moving. My mom had lots of different roommates that came and went. And so it was just, unstable is probably the best way to put it.
And in the midst of all that, you are incredibly intelligent, just like your mom. And I know as she finally did find the guy, the one, and your stepdad, that he was a good influence on you and encouraged education, and you were super intelligent. So that sounds like how the prep school came into the picture. And this academy that you attended is renowned. Students from 51 countries. You're among the best minds, not only in your peers, but in the faculty. I mean, presumably you have the most intellectual rigor that you can find. And so I'm wondering, as I'm listening to your story, is this where you find truth? Is this where you find faith? What happens there?
Actually not. It's not where I found faith. Interestingly, you'd think that would be where I found it, but I think that got me further away from faith. So just to fill in a few details to ensure, my mom, she finally got help, and then she came out of rehab after about a year, met my stepdad. And my stepdad is a tall, skinny guy with a mustache. He's always got a Dale Earnhardt hat on his head, and he's young. He's only 12 years older than I am. And he was an auto mechanic. And, you know, my first memory of him was, you know, coming in the door of our apartment. He had holy jeans on, and I just didn't like him at all. My mom liked him. And so he came over a few times. And then he brought me on a four-wheeling trip with his friend. So I went four-wheeling with him, which I loved. It was so much fun. And then he had this cherry red IROC Z with a T-top, and he let me program the radio stations on that car. And I thought that was the coolest thing that I'd ever done. And so he won me over. And then soon after, my parents got married, which was awesome. And I was in the wedding for my stepdad and my mom, which is, you know, you don't often get to be in your parents' wedding, but that's pretty cool. But, you know, Dan, my stepdad, he was really strict, and he pushed me to excel academically. He saw that I had promise, and he said, hey, you know, he expected all A's. If there was anything other than A on there, he was disappointed, and, you know, we were going to have words. And in fact, you know, he was my hockey coach and little league coach and soccer coach, and I wouldn't be able to play those games on the weekend if I didn't come home with straight A's. And so he pushed me really hard to do well, and it worked. He had me reading. I had to record myself reading books at night to ensure that he knew that I had read my books. But it was all for my good, and he really put me on the right track. And my mom, coming back from the long road where she was, she just was there and just loved me unconditionally through this all. And then my dad provided that structure that I had not had in years. And so one day my stepdad came home from work, and he had a pamphlet in his hand for Tabor Academy. And one of his coworkers had sent his daughter to this elite prep school in Massachusetts. And he said, "Hey, do you have any, does this look interesting to you? Would you like to do this? You could do an extra year or two, play hockey, increase your skills and experience, get a little bit better education, and then you can get into a better college and have a better outcome, you know, from your education." I said, "Well, that looks interesting." So we took a month or so to look at it and kind of ponder it, and then I decided that that was something that I wanted to do. And so we toured, I think probably 9 or 10 schools around New England, and one of those was Phillips Academy Andover. And Andover, my first impression there was that it was not at all for me. I felt totally in over my head. So I walked in there, this poor kid from Vermont. I probably had a pair of sneakers, ratty sneakers on, and I don't know what I was wearing, for clothes, but, it wasn't impressive. So I walked in, there's classical music playing. Just imagine, you know, fathers, wealthy fathers, and, you know, their three-piece suits, and, you know, and kids dressed in, you know, amazing outfits, and just this very richly decorated scene in this, you know, admissions office. And they brought me back in to talk with the admissions officer, and it looked like he needed a nap. He couldn't stop yawning. He looked incredibly bored. And so I walked out of there, and as I'm walking out toward the car, then a bird flies over me and poops on my shoulder. And I'm like, this is the worst. There's no way I'm getting into this place. And so I went home just, convinced that it was not going to happen for me, but to my great shock and surprise, I was accepted. And then honestly, it really came down to money, and they were able to give me the most generous package, financial aid package as well. And so it worked out well, and I was so excited to be at Andover. But even while I was there, I still felt like a fish out of water. So, you know, to give you an idea what Andover's like, you know, there are kids from all over the world, as you mentioned earlier. But generally they're pretty wealthy. There were very few kids like me, that I could see. And so kids would come up, they'd roll up in a limousine, the door would open, and then the kids would pop out, you know, and their, you know, the limo would continue on. In my dorm, I had an Indian prince and a Turkish prince. I had the heir to the Goodyear fortune. There was a brother of an NHL hockey player on my hockey team. And so there were all these people who were, I thought, you know, way smarter than me and way more talented than me. And so I really felt like I didn't belong there at Andover. But, you know, I held my own there. I did well academically. I played hockey and I grew a lot. It was really hard. There were many times that I cried at night just because there was so much work. In public school, I could do my homework during the day and I wouldn't have any homework at night. At Andover, I did work all evening and all weekend long. I was just doing work the entire time. And so there was no break and it was really stressful. So I think it really trained me really well to be very good in the academic realm, but at the same time, go ahead.
So well, we're up against a break, and I was just thinking when you were talking about the strictness of your stepdad, and that really put a trajectory, and there's a foundation of faith there when you look at the virtues. And when I was reading the biography of Clarence Thomas, he too would not be where he was today if it wasn't for a strong man in his life with kind of an absolute, the door swings in, but the door swings out if, you know, you're not able to adhere to these standards. And of course, we were living in a time where we don't like absolutes. And that's why heroes are kind of so unwanted, because heroes do deal in absolutes. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to hear about that faith journey, because this is when it really transforms. You are an intellectual setting that up, but now you intellectually find truth, beauty, and goodness, and how that changed your life, and then flying F-18s as well. I'm Brooke Taylor in for Timmery. This is Trending, and we are with Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to Trending on this feast of St. John Paul the Great. The number to call is 1-888-914-9149. My name is Brooke Taylor, in for Timmery, honored to be joined by Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari. Crisis Magazine has a great article about the life of Ali Ghaffari, and it's called The Last Dogfight for Our Children. We're hearing his story now, up to the point where, Ali, you are excelling at this prestigious academy in Massachusetts. And so by the time you graduate from this school and you're entering college, you are a committed atheist. And presumably, you've been around some extraordinary intellect. And so you think, well, you've had all the access to truth and you're not finding God. And somewhere along this line, you had a major paradigm shift. So what happened? What changed your life?
Yeah, great question. So coming out of Andover, I felt like I felt elite. I felt like I knew more than, you know, 99% of people out there. So there's a lot of hubris and pride that I carried with me. And I was on track to be a doctor. I wanted to do pre-medicine. And so all my professors were committed atheists. And so I continued that track in college. I went to Colby College up in Maine. And I was living the life of an atheist, living a hedonistic life, that I, as if God did not exist. And this was the way I lived until the summer between my sophomore and junior years. And there I met two men, changed my life that summer. So the first was a man named Stephen Brady, who was, you know, he was there that summer. He's a doctor, spent some time in the Navy. He was a Naval Academy grad, became a Navy SEAL, and then left the Navy, became a doctor on an Army's dime, and then he was there at the Academy. And so I was just totally blown away by this guy. And I thought that I was smart, but Stephen was way smarter than I was. And so I just latched on to Stephen because here was this guy who could, you know, kill you 100 ways. And he was incredibly intelligent.
But he was a Christian, right? He was a believer. He was a Christian.
Yes, he was. But he was an atheist at one point in time too. And then he had been convinced of the truth of Christianity. And so I had to take that seriously all of a sudden. If this guy that I really respected believed in God, all of a sudden I couldn't just dismiss Christians as being, you know, idiots. I just couldn't do that anymore. So I really had to take a hard look at it. And he challenged me to do so. And so the second gentleman I met that summer, his name is Paul. And Paul was our neighbor. And I didn't have a high opinion of Paul. So Paul had barely graduated from high school. But he was a self-made man. So he had multiple businesses. He'd done very well for himself, very hard worker. He was a bodybuilder. He had wild long hair. He knew a lot about music, just brilliant musician. But you know, that summer I went home for a party, and my stepdad Dan's on the porch with Paul and they're drinking a beer. And I'm like, this is my chance, because Dan is very quiet. And only when he has a beer in his hand and he's got a friend there does he actually open up, and I get to hear what's on his mind. And this is, you know, precious moment. So I jumped out there, just sat on the porch, and we're overlooking these beautiful mountains in Vermont. And Paul asks me, he said, "Hey, Ali, what are you doing this summer?" And I said, "I'm doing organic chemistry research." And he said, well, tell me about that. What are you doing? And I said, it's on these chemicals called carbenes. And he said, well, what are those? And I said, well, you wouldn't really understand. And he said, well, try me, you know, explain it to me. And I got about two questions in and realized I didn't have any idea what it is that I was doing for research for that entire summer. I didn't understand anything. And in a very split second, this man who barely graduated from high school just totally whipped the rug out from under me. Somebody who thought so highly of himself, who went to Andover, was at Colby College, almost had my degree. I was going to be this, you know, famous doctor. And he, you know, he basically said, you know, revealed that the emperor has no clothes. Well, I thought I was smart. I knew a lot of things surface level, just memorize, regurgitate, flush, move on. And that's it. I could play that game really well, but I didn't really know things. And Paul showed me that. And that was a really hard lesson for me. But in that same conversation, he said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "Well, no, there's no evidence for God." And he said, "Well, there's evidence all around. You just have to have eyes to see it." And so between Stephen and Paul, I had to now reevaluate my entire life. What I thought was true, I knew now was false. And I had to reevaluate who I was and where I was going to go and how I was going to behave, how I was to live my life based on this surprise and shock that I did not expect going into the summer.
It's Brooke Taylor in for Timmery and interviewing our special guest, Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari. And so in the beginning, you were sharing about your dad. I know your biological dad is Muslim, and they tried to make a go. It didn't work. Your mom eventually got stable and did amazing things, remarried. And so I'm wondering about your faith tradition and then how you came to fall in love and discover of all of this intellect and philosophy and this background that you began to study the truth of the Catholic Church.
Yes. So we didn't go to church hardly at all when I was growing up. But in high school, my mom said, "You're not getting out of the house without some God. It's part of my duty as a parent. I need to do that." So she made my brother and I go to a Methodist church. And so we went to this Methodist church and we joined the youth group begrudgingly. I didn't want to be there. I had no interest whatsoever. There was a cute
that
girl
sounds
in the
vaguely familiar. I think a lot of parents can relate.
Oh yeah, it was a struggle. But there was a cute girl there, so I kept on going just to spend time with her. And so, but I would say not much of it rubbed off on me. And carrying that forward, you know, with this now reevaluation of my life, if I was going to be anything, it was going to be Methodist, because my family was all Methodist, and that was kind of what I knew. But Paul challenged me, instead of just going for what I knew, what I was comfortable, what I thought was the most fun, to follow truth itself. And so I determined that whatever Paul was Catholic, was not true. And I was going to prove that it was not true. I was going to pull the rug out from under him. So I said, I'm going to learn Catholicism better than you know Catholicism, and I'm going to show you that you're wrong. And so for the next, 6-12 months or so, he and I battled back and forth via email. And I would throw everything I had against the Catholic Church at him. And he would just calmly deflect all of these things and answer them with reason, logic, history, theology. It was just beautiful, but it was infuriating for me. And so I would just get very angry every time I got a message back from him, that I'd gather more things and I'd throw all those things at him. And when I was out of things, I talked to my friends and family and said, "What do you have against the Catholics?" And I threw all those things at him. And then eventually I just got exhausted. And I said, "Paul, I can't beat you. Teach me." And so he did. And he said, "Let's start with Plato." And we started with Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, and then worked our way through the Church Fathers and all the way through to John Henry Newman, J.R. Tolkien, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, and into documents of Vatican II and into modern day theology. And I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away, because I had been convinced that truth didn't exist by society. Everyone said it's all relative, right? I could say that in my sleep. But here it was, this path of truth has existed for millennia, and it had been covered over. And to find it was such a relief for me. It was this pearl of great price that I will never let go of, because the life before, I was so unhappy. And the life with Christ in truth, in this hope, is so beautiful. And so it changed my life.
And again, the beauty of the unexpected, where again, you are moving in a world with amazing scholars and all that you think will give you access to truth. And it's from the most unexpected. And our Lord, of course, he was born in the most unexpected way, in the most unexpected place. And the First Corinthians verse, that God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and the beauty in that, and being invited into truth, beauty, goodness, and the transcendentals, which then becomes your mission. And there's so much of your story to unpack, but I do want to read an excerpt from Crisis Magazine, Kevin Wells, excellently written. It's called "The Last Dog Fight for Our Children." Of you, he writes this: he has flown jets at speeds over 1,000 miles per hour and landed them on moonless nights on aircraft carriers. He has been deployed by the Navy overseas multiple times, has flown more than 20 combat missions over Taliban-held territory in Afghanistan. He has seen the enemies of our country, but considers them inconsequential compared to the darkness coming at our children. This is his war. And the quote in the article says, "My conversion prepared me to attempt to create a new generation of saint leaders for our church." And so all that you did to defend your country and to promote leadership and to form others, you say there's a bigger war going on now for the souls of our children. It begins with our educational system, which forms the framework from which they view, understand, and act in life. And obviously you've been there, done that. That was your experience. So this now becomes your mission. And tell us a little bit about that. You did extensive study on the system of education, but then founding, you get your degree in philosophy and theology, master's, to then the call of education. When did this become so ingrained in your mission? Was it through your own experience, or just what you observed as you went through your own education?
I'd say it was all kind of going on concurrently. We're military, so we move around every 2 or 3 years and get to see a lot of Catholic schools around the country. We put our kids in a Catholic school here. And then as I'm maturing in my own faith and developing, my priorities start to focus more on the salvation of my children. And so as I think about their education or thought about it, I said, a great education is valuable, but I had a great education and it led me astray. And I think I was astray to begin with, but it didn't help bring me back to the truth, a great education being by worldly standards. And I don't want that for my kids. I didn't want them to have, you know, a Harvard education and lose their soul. Like that's, for me, is a waste and a serious loss. I wanted my kids to become saints first and foremost. And so this drive forced me to take a great interest in the education that my kids were having. And I was finding that the education they were receiving, while it was a great education, I love the teachers, great tradition, it just wasn't focused on salvation of my kids. And I wanted them to see a genuine and beautiful expression of Catholicism, and I just didn't see it there. But I was unsure of, you know, what to do. And in this, during this time, I heard about the beauty of classical liberal education through the example of a school named St. Jerome's Academy in Hyattsville, Maryland. And this school was, you know, your average parish school. It was pretty much a public school with a dabbling of Catholicism in it. And they were losing kids, you know, left and right. And they were told they had to close. And then a grouping of parents and teachers got together and they said, hey, we've got nothing to lose here. Let's try to go back to the intellectual patrimony of the church. Let's go back to this classical liberal education, which was what the church, how they taught all of us Catholics, you know, from the very beginning. And it was, in fact, it preceded them with the Greeks. And this is how people were taught up until the early 1900s when things changed. And so let's go back to that, because that worked really well. Produced St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, you know, you name the saint, in all likelihood, they were formed by this classical education. And so let's do that. And so they did. They spent 6 months working on a curriculum. They unfurled it the next fall. And that school has continued to grow every year. And it's to the point where people are moving from around the country to put their kids in that school. And that school is now one of the largest in the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. And I heard about that. I'm like, I want that for my kids.
Yeah. And it's the beauty. It's the truth. It's the goodness. Classical education. It's the study of grammar, logic, rhetoric, Latin, developing the whole child. Am I missing anything there? I'm sure I am. But just the sacraments.
There's a lot, but it is. And it's so, it's inspiring. I think the biggest thing is the goal of the education is essentially to create a saint. You know, the goal of our modern secular education is for a child to go to college, get into a good college and get a good job, and then that's it. So it's creating slaves or servants, materialists who are going to be cogs in this wheel. They can create money, create and then consume. And that's it. That's the end goal of it. I think it doesn't aim high enough. The classical aim is to create the best version of yourself with regard to God, God at the center of all these things, to form your soul, to form you in virtue. And so that's the beauty of the classical education. And it does it by inspiring kids through the greatest works that have ever been written in Western civilization. And these works have inspired millions of people. And so and they still inspire our kids if we only give them that material to read and to consume.
Well, you did an extensive... there was a study that you did on the system of education, and it's both in a contemporary sense where we are now, but also historically, as you were kind of touching on there, and you found that over half of grads now identify as socialist. We know that kids are leaving the faith in droves. Nearly half of all Americans read and write so poorly that it's difficult to hold a job. I was really astounded by that. And so you think if we really truly care about our kids, this should be a critical call to action when you look at what the classical approach can bring. And you also mentioned something, I was looking at a little study that you did about the Frankfurt School. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just preface this by saying, in no way, shape, or form am I a conspiracy theorist. And but this is something that I did research on, and it's out there. And so going back to World War I and the Communist Revolution, communists take over Russia in the early to mid 1910s, 1918, in that range. And once they've taken over Russia, they set their eyes then on Western Europe and on Americans, and they're strategizing how do we bring communism over there. And the biggest obstacle they faced was Christianity, the Christian culture that was just imbued and held in great esteem in Europe. in America. And they said, well, if we're going to take it down, we have to take it down by undermining virtue, and we have to undermine the family. And so they sought to get rid of morality by emphasizing immoral action, predominantly just within relationships between men and women, but also ridiculing fathers and undermining their authority. And so they became pulled away from the family as well. So they started to nibble away at the fibers which bound Western civilization. At the same time, they formed this think tank, is probably a good way to describe it, called the Frankfurt School in Germany. And out of there, they started to kind of propagate this propaganda, which was proposing this Marxist view of the world to Western Europe. And one of the things that the Frankfurt School created, came up with, is called critical theory. And the critical theory, the basis of that is to pit different groups within a civilization against one another to create division and infighting so that they can then sweep away the superstructure of what is there and replace it with communism. And so this they used to great effect within Germany, which allowed Hitler to come to power, and then also in China to bring communism to China. And so during World War II, they were chased out of Germany and then landed at Columbia's Teachers College, where they found a gentleman named John Dewey and his followers there, who were propagating kind of a socialist pragmatist philosophy of education, which discounted history, discounted virtue. They wanted to separate families and children. They thought the state could educate them better. They wanted to get rid of God. But John Dewey wasn't a revolutionary. Yep. Sorry, go ahead,
Brooke. I'm writing down John Dewey. I'm taking notes. We have to take a break. I want to stop right there because you're getting into the meat of something that sounds very familiar with what we are experiencing. And you're coming at it from a Catholic, a parent, and a headmaster. We will revisit that when we get right back from the break. My name is Brooke Taylor in for Timmery. My guest is Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari, former atheist, F-18 Navy jet fighter pilot, and now headmaster of Divine Mercy Academy. We will be right back with more. Stay with us.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to Trending. My name is Brooke Taylor in for Timmery. The number to call is 1-888-914-9149. Welcome your calls if you have a question for Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari. We only have less than 10 minutes left of the program, which went so fast, listening to Lieutenant Commander's story, his testimony, his own journey, and his mission now for the souls of our young people, talking about the education system. We left off talking about John Dewey, the Frankfurt School, I would say an infiltration aimed at dismantling, undermining the integrity of our schools to the place we are now, which is a lot of confusion. I know that the pandemic has played a big role in this, but for you, Lieutenant Commander, what I think is so beautiful is that you have a mission to build, and that's what you've done in Divine Mercy Academy. So I guess maybe if you could, let's go back to what you were saying about the Frankfurt School and then take us into your own mission in Divine Mercy Academy.
Okay, thank you. So the Frankfurt School, the members of that school came over with John Dewey and John Dewey's followers at Columbia Teachers College. And Columbia Teachers College was a hub of educational leadership. I think at one point in time, a third of all educational leaders went through that curriculum. And so there they were able to drip the poison of Marxist ideology into the veins of the American educational system, where it slowly but surely gained currency and became the law of the land. And so that's how we essentially have the vast majority of our universities and secondary schools and now elementary schools are filled with folks who are taken in by this Marxist ideology. And so that was then propagated into our Catholic school system. So that was predominantly through the public schools. But in our Catholic schools, we had a decline in vocations. And we had to replace those vocations with secular teachers, and some of those teachers may have been Catholics, some may not have, and a good portion of them were not entrained in this Marxism. And so that's how it came into the church. In addition, our schools were hard, you know, they needed more money because they now cost to educate went up, and so they needed to start to take in government funding, and those that funding comes with strings attached, and that comes with some of those curricular materials that have this embedded in it. So our Catholic schools declined as a result of that infusion of Marxism back in Columbia's Teachers College. So seeing all of this, I decided I want to do something about it. And the answer I came up with was to start a classical school. And so there were others in the area who had done it with a 2-day-a-week school. I spoke with them. They said, we think the time is right to start a 5-day-a-week school. And so there were others who immediately came to me and said, hey, we heard you're thinking about starting it. We want in. And these amazing people partnered. We went shoulder to shoulder and just did the hard work of building a school out of nothing. And it took us a year to get it off the ground. There were some really hard moments there where I wasn't sure if it was going to happen or not. We had one point in time where we just had, I think, maybe 11 students. And there was one family with 4 of those 11 students who said, there's not enough kids. We have to pull our kids out. And it convinced them just to leave one in. So they left one kid in. And then we had 3 headmaster candidates who were initially very excited, saw how much work it was, and then turned us down. And then it was just a God moment. Said, God, I'm doing everything I can to make this happen. If this is going to fail, it's because you let it fail. And I need you to step up. And the very next day, God laughed and he said, he gave me this beautiful woman, Marietta Jeske, gave me a call. She had 3 kids. She was a classical art teacher, and she had a desire to help in any way she could. And from that point forward, we had the momentum. We opened our doors with 19 kids and 4 teachers that next fall. The following year, we grew to 45 kids and 9 teachers. And this year, we're at 89 kids and 13 teachers and set to continue to grow.
Praise be to God. And I saw your patrons are St. Faustina, St. Kateri, St. John Paul II. So yes. What a gift that he would allow you to share this story on his feast day. We have just a few minutes left, but I want to end on a note of hope and encouragement, and I guess a little bit of advice. You were on the faculty of the Naval Academy teaching leadership. You are the president of a leadership coaching and consulting company. It's called the Frassati Company. So you understand how desperately we need good leaders, virtuous leaders. What advice can you offer to parents and I guess to young people in forming the leaders that God is calling us to in this time and era?
Yeah, I would say do the right thing, even if it's harder, even if it causes you to sacrifice something. Doing the right thing and taking the hard path inspires other people, and they want to join you. I think it's very easy to take the easier path, the wider path, and then to water things down and to become just like everybody else and to avoid conflict. But that's not the way out of this. It's how we got into this. And so taking those risks and then going all in for God is the way to do it. And then people see that and they're inspired by it.
And in your book list, you talked about one of the roads that led you back to, well, not back, but I guess to Rome, to the Catholic Church, was the beautiful literature and the church fathers, the writings that you were introduced to. If you were to just cherry pick a few foundational books for your library, what books would you recommend for titles?
Yes, Four Witnesses. Four Witnesses is a book that follows 4 of the earliest church fathers, 3 of them being disciples at the feet of St. John the Apostle. And it goes through their lives and deaths, and then has all of their quotes, and then it puts the teachings of the church immediately next to those things, the current teachings of the church. And it shows that it's been continuous from the beginning of the church to now. And I literally cried at the end of that book because this is so beautiful. This is so amazing. And it was incredible just to see that just laid out so beautifully. Additionally, there is the Eucharistic Miracles book by Joan Carol Cruz, which was phenomenal. Just nobody's heard of Eucharistic Miracles outside of Catholics. And so just being able to see the beauty and the historicity and the pictures and the stories was amazing to have that. And then the Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger. That book goes into the history of the sacred scriptures, how they came to be, how they're different. And that was a phenomenal book to read as well. So those 3.
Wow. Thank you. Lieutenant Commander Ali Ghaffari, former atheist, Navy fighter pilot, husband, father, foster father, headmaster of Divine Mercy Academy. And I'm taking notes as you were writing down those books. I also want to mention at the top of the show, I had shared a story that was relayed of Pope John Paul II being likened to Frodo and a gentleman that he met, like Samwise Gamgee. And so there was a request of what book was that from? It was Dr. Peter Kreef's latest book. It's called How to Destroy Western Civilization. I actually had a chance to interview him. You can find that on my YouTube channel, which is just under The Brooke Taylor Show. But thank you again for all of this wealth of information. And is there a place that people can get in touch with you, Lieutenant Commander, if they want to know more about Divine Mercy Academy and what you're doing, the Frassati, the leadership consulting company that you have?
Yeah, if you just go to divinemercy.md, that's it. That's for our school, divinemercy.md. And then for the leadership, it's the Frassati Company. .com as in Blessed Pierre Giorgio Frassati, the Frassati Company.com.
Thank you so much. God bless you. I want to end on the poetry of St. John Paul II. He had a nom de plume, and it was called Gruta, which means clod of earth. And he talked about a poem which was his homeland, and he had a poem called My Country. He said, "When I think of my country, I look for a road running upwards like a high voltage current cutting through slopes. This outdoorsman, a poet, priest, pope, and patriot, pray for us." My name is Brooke Taylor. God bless you.